Greetings, everyone, and welcome to our weekly podcast on legal issues in the post-COVID world. My name is Gil Porter, a partner at Haynes & Boone and chair of our COVID-19 task force. Today is Thursday, June 11, and our topic today is poison pills. No, this is not another rant about hydroxychloroquine. We are talking about shareholder rights plans that can assist a company to, among other things, resist unwanted suitors. With the volatility in stock prices arising from the COVID-19 pandemic, companies face the prospect of a discrepancy between the market price of their stock and their intrinsic value. This is a topic of current importance to many public traded companies. For this discussion, we're joined by my partner, Jennifer Wozinski, who chairs Haynes & Boone's Business Transactions Department. She has more than 20 years' experience in a broad range of corporate governance matters, as well as transactional matters, ranging from capital markets to private and public M&A. Nathan Koppel, our head of media relations, after a one-week respite, will resume his role as moderator for this series. I will turn this over to Nathan in a moment, but before we begin, our disclaimer. This podcast is for informational purposes only, is not intended to be legal advice, and does not establish an attorney-client relationship. By their very nature, the topics we discuss in these podcasts will be fast-moving and subject to change. Legal advice of any nature should be sought from your legal counsel. That's it from me. Let me turn over to Nathan.
Gil, many thanks for the introduction. Jennifer, let's start things off by having you describe poison pills, please.
Sure, Nathan. A poison pill or rights plan is a takeover defense, and they are designed to deter certain coercive tactics in people trying to take over a company. And the way they do that is with the threat of massive dilution. And that massive dilution can occur if someone comes in and acquires common stock exceeding the ownership threshold that's set forth in the rights plan without getting the consent of the board of directors. And over the years, rights plans have been very effective in deterring those acquisitions. One of the things that I find really interesting about rights plans is, you know, most takeover defenses are going to be found in either the company's charter or their bylaws, or maybe their state corporate governance law. A rights plan is a contract, and it's between the company and the rights agent, who's usually the transfer agent, and really the rights agent is there for administrative purposes. This gives the company, the board, a significant benefit in being able to put a rights plan in place very quickly because it does not require stockholder approval from a legal perspective. So what happens if the board adopts a rights plan, the board will make a distribution of rights, and they'll distribute one right for each share of common stock that's outstanding. Now, when those rights are distributed, they're not exercisable initially, and they don't exist separate from the common stock. So if you were to go out and sell your common stock the next day, you couldn't say, well, I'm going to keep the rights and sell the stock. And they go together. But the magic happens at some time in the future if you have someone come in and acquire beneficial ownership of the common stock over that threshold that's designated in the plan. And what happens then is the right automatically becomes a right to buy common stock at a steep discount to the current market price. Usually it's 50%. And all the stockholders, other than the stockholder who triggered the plan, have the right to buy those shares at a significant discount. And so to give it a quick example, let's say the current market price of the stock is $20 at the time the pill is triggered. And let's say the exercise price in the rights plan is $80. So what that means is that each stockholder, other than the one who triggered the pill, can buy 8 shares of stock at $10 a share or $80 in the aggregate for each share of stock they own. And so you can imagine the dilution that could happen if everybody exercises those rights and gets 8 additional shares for every share they own, and the person that triggered the pill gets nothing. And so from a number standpoint, you can see the acquiring person go from a 15% ownership to less than 2% just through exercise of the rights plan. And so that is really, you know, where you get that significant dilution and what deters people from triggering a pill in the first place.
Is there usually a typical a percentage ownership that triggers the poison pill?
Well, it does vary quite a bit, but I would say historically the most common trigger threshold is from 10 to 15%. Now, you know, in some respects, it's going to depend on the company's facts and circumstances, but, you know, 10 to 15% is the most common, but it can vary anywhere from 4.99% if you're trying to protect net operating losses to 20% or greater if they're trying to just set a higher threshold.
And are these plans usually triggered, Jennifer, or does the mere existence of them usually prevent takeovers from taking place?
For the most part, the mere existence is enough of a deterrence. There really have only been a couple of pills triggered over the years. One was triggered very early on and when pills first started being used. And then there was a pill that was triggered more recently, and that was with Selectica. And that pill was triggered intentionally, but it's very rare to see.
I'm going to pivot here to the present circumstances with the COVID-19 pandemic and just get your thoughts about whether market volatility, what it is right now. Is this a particularly apt time for companies to consider adopting rights plans?
It is a really good time for companies to be considering rights plans and really all takeover defenses generally, not just the rights plan, because what happens, you know, when you see the type of stock price decline that we all saw in mid-March, you know, where the stock price of many companies went down at least 50% or even more in some cases, what that does is, you know, people who are out there on the fringe kind of thinking, well, I may want to come in and buy this company or buy a significant stake. When the price goes down like that, they're automatically going to be interested in coming out and buying some shares. And so we certainly have seen that already with several companies. Carl Icahn, for example, has gone in and bought stakes in you know, more than one company since the pandemic began. And so from the board's perspective, you know, they're trying to protect the interest of the stockholders and trying to increase the long-term value of the company. And so they don't necessarily want someone coming in and buying the stock at what they consider to be a very much an undervalued price. And so considering takeover defenses so that you can make sure that the board has the time and the leverage to negotiate with would-be acquirers is going to be, you know, very helpful to the company. It's generally going to be in the interest of the stockholders. And, you know, keep in mind, too, that when you have someone out there who's a hostile agitator, that can, you know, cause tremendous stress for the company. It takes tremendous time of senior management, of the board. It can negatively impact the company's relationships with its employees, with its customers, with its suppliers. It just can be very disruptive. So having good defenses in place to start with can be very helpful in avoiding those situations.
And I know many companies are currently under a lot of stress already just operating amid the pandemic. So you can understand why they would want to have these sorts of defenses in place. Jennifer, can you walk us through some of the different terms that are typical in rights plans?
Sure. So, you know, the trigger threshold, which you asked about a few minutes ago, is obviously one of the key ones. And so setting, you know, figuring out what the right trigger threshold is for the company is going to be very important. You know, one thing that we've been seeing recently in a lot of the rights plans that's been adopted is having a dual trigger. And what's meant by that is you have the regular threshold at 10, 15, you know, whatever percent that is. But then there's a separate higher percentage that applies to passive institutional investors. And so those are people who are filing under Schedule 13G as opposed to Schedule 13D. And those exemptions can allow those types of holders to go up to 19.99%. Sometimes the board, they can set it a little bit lower than that. Maybe they don't want them to go up that high. They could set it at 15%. But basically, the company is able to go out to an investor like Vanguard or BlackRock and say, look, you know, we welcome a significant investment by you in our company, and we realize that you our passive institutional investor, we're putting this rights plan in place to, you know, deal with potential hostile acquirers, but, you know, we'll allow you to buy more than that because you're passive. You know, the second term that I would, or the second term in a rights plan I would talk about is the term. So when rights plans first started being used, it was very common to have a 10-year term. And when that 10 years was up, the board would look at it and say, okay, we're going to renew for another 10 years. And that happened for a while until you had ISS and other corporate governance parties that came out and, you know, they really didn't like rights plans or poison pills, they would call them, and thought they were an entrenchment device. And so what you've seen based on that influence is that today, most rights plans do not have a term that exceeds 1 year. And a lot of that is based on the influence of ISS, Glass Lewis, and others. And part of their rationale is that, look, you know, if you have an activist come on the scene, those types of situations usually tend to get resolved within a year. So if you have an activist come in and you say you want to adopt a rights plan, you don't need to have it out there for 5 years. If you have it out there for 1 year, that should be sufficient to deal with that threat. So if a company for some reason wants to go more than a year on a term, they really need to think hard about that and the rationale and understand that they may get some pushback on that. The exercise price is another key feature of the plan. And, you know, as was demonstrated in the example I gave a few minutes ago, it really goes to how many shares of stock a person can buy when the rights are exercisable. Now, historically, the exercise price was, people set that at what they thought the long-term value of the stock price was. And typically that was a multiple of anywhere from 3 to 6 of the stock price of the company at the time the rights plan was adopted. Now, say in the plans that have been adopted recently, we've seen some multiples that were higher than that. But I think, you know, you could come back and say, well, maybe they were basing their multiple off of a pre-pandemic stock price that they believe is more representative of the stock price value. I will say whether the exercise price is a multiple of 3 or 6 or 10 of the stock price, I'm not really sure that there's a lot of practical impact of that in terms of when the rights plan gets triggered, because, you know, even as you saw in my example with a multiple of 4, it's tremendous dilution. And whether you're taking someone down to 2% or 1% or 0.5%, I'm not sure really makes a big difference. The last two provisions I'll mention quickly in rights plans that people talk about today are covering derivatives and covering people who are acting in concert. So derivatives is something that's, you know, was not around when rights plans started. But, you know, as people started using derivatives to and were able to either acquire a significant economic stake in the company or yield significant influence just through the ownership of derivatives, companies started wanting to cover those in poison pills. And the acting in concert language is also a reaction to, you know, companies being nervous about hedge funds, having multiple hedge funds come in and acquire their stock. And maybe they weren't forming a, you know, 13D group. They didn't have a formal agreement between themselves, but they were basically acting with a common goal or had similar investment objectives. And again, were able to yield significant influence on the company. And so some companies, and I would say about a third of the plans adopted this year include this language that says, if you're acting with a stated common goal with others, and the language gets defined differently in different plans, then we may aggregate your ownership for purposes of the pill. And so that is something that companies, you know, the Delaware courts haven't really directly ruled on the enforceability of that language yet, but it is something that you're starting to see just so that companies can try to address the issue with multiple hedge funds or wolf packs.
So assuming, that was extremely helpful, thank you. Assuming a board of directors decides that it really makes sense to adopt a rights plan to protect shareholders, what steps would they take to implement it?
Sure. So there are several things that kind of go along with that. You know, I think the first is obviously legal counsel and usually outside legal counsel would prepare a draft rights plan, you know, review the company's existing takeover defenses. And, you know, we typically put together, you know, documents that kind of explain what rights plans are, what they do, what they don't do, some of the pros and cons. And, you know, because you want to make sure as part of the board's process that they, you know what they're looking at adopting. And so, you have kind of all those set of documents. Then in terms of helping make sure the board is fulfilling their fiduciary duties, it's important to understand that if the board is adopting a rights plan in response to an actual or perceived threat, then the courts will look at from a fiduciary duty standpoint, whether the rights plan was a reasonable response to a reasonable threat. And so in terms of establishing whether it's a reasonable response, there are a number of considerations that can go into that. You know, one is, what is the company's existing takeover defense profile look like? If they are already pretty bulletproof, then maybe a rights plan doesn't really add that much, versus a company that really doesn't have many defenses at all. Then, you know, adding a rights plan would certainly seem to be more reasonable in that context. Looking at, you know, what is the current takeover environment? Like we were just talking about right now with the steep stock price declines and the pandemic, you know, it's encouraging people to come out and, you know, consider hostile activity. So that is another consideration for the board to take into account. There may be particular facts that impact the company's vulnerability to a hostile attack. It may have to do with their liquidity or something going on with their contracts. They may already have an activist on the scene. So considering those types of things is important. And then, you know, on the other side, the company also needs to consider, and the board should consider, what message will adopting a rights plan to send to shareholders? Will there be shareholders who will be upset by that they should maybe engage with and explain the rationale to and why they're looking to do that? And it's not to prevent any takeover, but it's to prevent unfair takeovers. And, you know, finally, it's also really important to consider how ISS and Glass Lewis, the proxy advisory firms, are going to view the adoption of the rights plan, because they can have a very significant practical impact on the company's, even the board elections going forward, if they are really unhappy with the rights plan the company adopted. Because in some cases, they will view the adoption of a rights plan as a poor governance practice. And what they'll do is they'll start recommending a vote against or a vote withhold on some or all of your board of directors just in your regular annual elections. And, you know, if you're a company that has a majority vote standard, and you have a bunch of your directors get a bunch of against votes because of the ISS or Glass Lewis recommendations, you know, that can impact whether they get the vote that they need to continue in office. So it, and even if it doesn't get to that standpoint, it can be, you know, something that's just, you know, negative publicity the company doesn't want to deal with.
I think finally, Jennifer, I'm just going to ask you to look ahead and let us and say whether you think their companies will face an enhanced risk of takeovers for an extended period of time. Do you think these will continue to be popular rights plans, that is, for the near term?
Well, I think, you know, if you look back to the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, what we saw then was that hostile activity seemed to continue for, you know, an extended period after the immediate crisis was resolved. And if you look back at the number of proxy contests, for example, that were conducted in 2009, I think that was a record number. And so we would expect that, you know, for some period of time, especially as, you know, a lot of companies have gained back significant traction in their stock price since the middle of March, but we're still continuing to see significant volatility in the stock market. So I think, you know, it would be reasonable to say that the hostile activity could go on an uptick for a period of time. And, you know, board should be looking at and considering whether a rights plan would be appropriate for their company.
Jennifer, thank you so much for that really excellent overview of shareholder rights plans. I want to refer listeners to a comprehensive article that Jennifer co-authored with some other Haynes and Boone lawyers. It's available on our COVID-19 resource page at haynesboone.com and is titled "The Best Offense is a Good Defense, Considering a Rights Plan in Light of COVID-19. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to you, Gil.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer and Nathan, for that informative discussion about one important and timely strategy to maintain corporate value in a challenging market. And thank you to our listeners for joining our COVID-19 podcast series. Next week's webinar and podcast will focus on some unique estate planning strategies to consider in the wake of the economic impact of the COVID pandemic. As a reminder, you can find our podcasts, webinars, and other content at haynesboone.com. That's HAYNESBOONE. Please also feel free to reach out to me or to Nathan Koppel if you have any suggestions for further podcast topics. Take care, all, and good night.